You're listening to the TV Obsessive Channel, presented by TVObsessive.com.
Hello and welcome back to the TV Obsessive Podcast. This is episode 33. My name is Ryan Kirksey. I'm a writer and contributor for TVObsessive.com. And I'm joined again by Cameron Crane, executive editor for the site. Cameron, time is a flat circle, I guess, based on what we're going to talk about today.
Indeed. And we need some beer cans.
Yeah, that's right.
Smash.
Cigarettes and beer cans, what we need for the conversation today.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about True Detective Night Country Part 2, aka Season 4, Episode 2. These don't have titles. I think the previous seasons actually did have episode titles, so...
They did.
Read into that if you like.
It's interesting. You go to Wikipedia or the HBO page. The first four are labeled Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, Part 4. And then 5 and 6 are TBA. You know, like they're not going to be Part 5 or 6. Like,
they're going to give us titles later.
Yeah.
That's weird. That's funny if that ends up being the case. But yeah, we're going to dig into that episode, the latter part of the pod. First, we'll talk a bit about what's been in the news, what we've been watching. That's maybe relatively brief. We were just meeting to talk about Fargo, and we're kind of switching up our schedule here a little bit. We're going to put these out on Sunday night, right after True Detective airs. We're recording a little bit early. I don't think it's too early. I don't think like the world's going to radically change between right now and Sunday night. We're putting this out on January 21st, 2024. That's what week it is. What do you got, Ryan? What have you noticed the past few days?
Well, I mean, even since we last recorded, apparently White Lotus Season 3 is going to be the best, you know, best season of TV in history, right?
Best
I mean,
cast ever.
They just keep adding Hall of Famers all over the place. So we've got the past couple days, the announcement of Walton Goggins going to be on White Lotus Season 3, joining several others, most notably maybe Patrick Schwarzenegger. So this joins the Michelle Monaghan, Parker Posey group that we had already. Several big names now on this. This is not only a great cast, but a massive cast they have for this season.
Oh yeah, and it's like a Cameron's favorite actor list. Walton Goggins and Carrie Coon and Parker Posey, and like if they had like Justin Theroux, I might just like explode in joy.
White Lotus, Thailand, colon, the leftover season.
No, Kyle MacLachlan. Like, oh my god. But anyway, those people aren't in it. But yeah, Walt Goggins. I love Walton Goggins. Also, he's looking forward to him in the Fallout show that comes out in April, which Kyle MacLachlan is in. See, there's connections.
That's right.
But yeah, White Lotus season 3, really ever increasing in excitement with the casting notice. It's a very character driven show, so it does kind of matter in that way.
I think this has to be getting towards the end. I think they're filming next month, so I mean we're probably about done with the casting announcements, but who knows.
Well yeah, and also like how many people can there be?
Exactly.
I expect, you know, like four couples or something like this, people on the staff, you know. I mean, past seasons have had a relatively big cast, I suppose.
Yes.
Kind of ensemble. On a negative note, just briefly, I think Apple TV Plus has canceled Schmigadoon. You ever watch Schmigadoon?
I have seen a little bit of Schmigadoon, only because I may be one of the world's biggest Cicely Strong fans. Loved her when she was on Saturday Night Live. She was one of my favorite characters. So I can't say that I'm deep into this show, but I have seen it. And this has quite a following, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's been on my list as something that I wanted to check out at some point and I haven't gotten around to it. And I feel extra bad about that. Clay Dockery has written on it for the site on season 1 and season 2. And from the perspective of having a deep knowledge of musical theater, which I thought was great, you know, I was like, yeah, like dig into that. You like dig into the references, all of that kind of stuff. So I do recommend the articles you have on the site on that front as far as Clay was. You're really trying to do that. And so, yeah, there's definitely a following for the show. And unfortunately, it appears they've written all the episodes for a third season and 25 songs. So, like, maybe it'll get revived somewhere else. I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that. I think his name is Cinco Paul, one of the creators of the show. Immediately after the announcement, obviously, he was prepared for this. Apple TV puts out a notice. They're not renewing it. He goes to social media, I mean, the next minute, and says, the optimist in me says feels that this is not the end of Schmigadoon. So he thinks it might get picked up somewhere else.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm getting ever so slightly worried about Apple TV Plus because you remember how, like, several years ago, you kind of had this feeling like Netflix was a place that would take chances, and like put out BoJack Horseman, and stuff like that. Netflix is no longer that, right? And I started to think maybe Apple TV Plus was sort of that. The first thing I recall them canceling was Mr. Corman, which I thought fair. Did you ever watch that?
No.
Okay. I thought it was fair because I always had the impression I was the only one who liked it. You know what I mean? I wrote on it. I saw other critics panning it and whatever. But you had some of these other shows that feel a little bit niche. Schmigadoon, The After Party. Like, it felt like they're taking some chances, and we're seeing them canceling Schmigadoon. They canceled The After Party also, for what it's worth. So I don't know. I don't know if these are canaries in the coal mine, but
Yeah, it's interesting. We've talked at length about their strength in certain genres, but they have distanced themselves from other things, it seems.
yeah, and I mean, like, Schmigadoon, people like musicals, but it is kind of like not everyone does. There are people like, I'm not watching a musical. And so here's a show that is a musical that's also mining humor from nerdy references to the histories, history of musical theater, and like that's the thing. So of course, for some people who are like, man, this is my bag, but it's not the kind of thing that is going to be ever broadly popular, like Ted Lasso or something. So I don't know. Curious where Apple
Well,
TV goes.
if it's written and the season is ready for production, it would not surprise me to see it somewhere else in the near future.
Yeah, we're supposed to have to shoot it and spend the money
Yeah,
and
of course, of course.
whatever.
Well, there is one show that's lasted a little bit longer than two seasons. We saw this that Law and Order SVU kicked off its 25th season this week. Mariska Hargitay has been on for now more than 530 episodes, leading the way there. There's only one other United States primetime show that has lasted longer than Law and Order SVU, and that's The Simpsons.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you were going to ask me to guess, I was like, I'm ready for this journey. God, The Simpsons. I can't believe. Do you ever think about how, like, I remember when The Simpsons premiered? I remember when The Simpsons was a bit on the Tracey Ullman show. And then they're like, we're going to make this its own show. And I was a kid, but I was like, oh, I like that,
I remember being 10 or 11 years old and my parents saying, "Oh no, that's not for you. That's not allowed in this house."
Oh yeah, you had that kind of, I didn't have that. I was watching R-rated movies and stuff when I was like 9 years old. But to think about how long that's been on and the fact that, you wouldn't even have to be all that young to have been born significantly after when The Simpsons started, I don't know. But yeah,
And
long.
that's what's shocking is Simpsons has been on 10 years longer than SVU, and SVU is like 540 episodes now.
Yeah, I didn't quite realize that. I guess I haven't been paying a lot of attention to Law and Order. Because, like, didn't they end the flagship? Like, isn't there no longer just plain old Law and Order?
Well, they ended it 2.5 years ago and then brought it back
They brought it
this
back.
year. So they now, so SVU is now past the flagship in terms of length of time and number of episodes. But there's all these rotating characters in and out, but Mariska Hargitay has been there from the very beginning,
I think
the
there's
first episode.
also a new Law and Order coming up. I think I've seen an ad for this while I was watching football, like Law and Order Organized Crime or
Organized
something.
crime, it's going to have this Elliot Stabler character. I mean, it's going to be a Chicago night, Law and Order night, comedy night. I mean, that's just how these things work.
Yeah, I just wonder if the Organized Crime one will be more serial. I don't know.
Yeah,
I
maybe.
don't know a lot about it. Should look into that. I used to watch Law and Order. Used to be something that back in the day when I was just using cable, like, oh, what's on TV? And you like flip through and like, well, Law and Order is on TNT 23 hours a day. I guess I'll watch Law and Order.
It really is the perfect show to just fall asleep to, while you're making food, while you're trying to do something else, just have it on. I mean, just great in background show.
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing to like put on. I think we have a lot in terms of new things we've been watching. I picking up on the game show kick I've been on watching,
No,
Match Game and Celebrity Jeopardy. I'm on Hulu and I'm like, well, what's this new game show with Rob Lowe called The Floor? So I decided to check this out. Have you heard anything about this?
I thought I'd seen a Rob Lowe trailer of him doing a game show, but no, I don't know anything about this.
All right. So the setup's a little convoluted, but I think it's cool. Okay. So first of all, there's a floor.
Floor, it's good.
All right. And it's like the contestants each have a square on the floor, basically, right? And so the goal of the game is ultimately going to be to take over spaces on the floor, kind of like you're playing Go or something, okay? But each contestant has their self-proclaimed area of expertise.
I
I don't know how they
see.
did this in the background exactly, but you go on the show and you'd be like, I'm a Saturday morning cartoon expert, everything. And then they randomly select someone. They say it's random anyway. And then they have to challenge one of the people who have an adjacent square to them. That's far? All right. This is a little
I got it so
convoluted. Yeah.
far. I'm
And
good.
so you've been randomly selected, then you have to choose, which person you want to challenge, and you challenge them in their area of expertise, as it were, right? And then the two contestants come out, and usually or often it's images, sometimes it's text-based, but they put things up on the screen and you have to say what they are, basically. And then it's just timer-based. So they'll go back and forth, but if you pass, you lose 3 seconds. And basically, it's just whoever runs out of time first loses.
Okay,
All right.
okay. This is a lot of
And
news, but I got it so far.
yeah, see, it's a little bit complicated, but it's important to the overall enjoyment of the thing because there's more, in terms of it being a little bit complicated, which I guess I'll try to forego the nitty-gritty, but it's like you end up taking over the other person's category, and then you have a choice of if you go back to the floor, then potentially you're going to have to defend this area of expertise that was this other person's area of expertise. So your choice is to go back to the floor and just kind of stand there, or keep going, keep challenging someone else. And of course, I watch this and I'm constantly like, if I was on the show, just like keep challenging people until I lost. I know myself. Yeah.
So
But
you need to
these.
have a pretty, maybe shallow, but really broad lake of knowledge of things.
Yeah, I guess if you're good at trivia or whatever.
Yeah. If I went up there and told them my areas of expertise are 1990s Houston Astros and Jeopardy betting strategy, I'm probably not going to get on the show, right?
That might be a little too niche. But I mean, I did see people whose like specialties were spices. One of them was like college sports teams, or so I think it's a little bit niche. But yeah, then it's like one of the things interesting about this too as a game show is it actually is a serial competition. So at the end of each episode, whoever owns the most space on the floor gets $20,000
I
for
see.
that day's episode. But it's an ongoing competition. The ultimate goal is to be like the last person standing and own the entire floor, and then you win way more money. I don't know what it is, like $250,000 or whatever. So there's kind of a lot of strategy to it. It's cool.
I'm always up for a good trivia and strategy show, so let me check that out.
It's definitely something. This is currently airing. So I discovered it, and now it's like, oh, I have to wait a week. And as I say, it's almost like other TV, where I'm like, but it's an ongoing thing, which is cool. I like that, but I think this is also one that would be very enjoyable to binge after the season's aired, because it
Yeah, I was
does
gonna say
carry
you
forward
can
through.
binge it after a period of time. All right. I'm gonna check that out. I'm gonna
It's
check it out.
Rob Lowe.
I've not caught up on anything new since we last spoke. Finished Echo, which I may have to invite Isabel on the show here to debate her. I thought is there some things I agree with her on, but thought overall the show was quite poor.
Yeah.
It was to be expected. They had a kind of had to Frankenstein the thing together after a lot of troubled production, but it neither here nor there. Just finish that up. I mean, I've just been basically spent the last 4 days, thinking about True Detective and all the interconnectivity and the theories and what's going to happen here. So that's what's on in my brain right now.
Yeah, let's get to talking about it because, yeah, okay, we're getting into it here with part two of True Detective Night Country. So, as per usual, we'll have a little music, 10, 15 seconds. And on the other side, we're going to discuss True Detective Night Country, part four, aka season four, episode two. I'm sorry, I totally flubbed that. Part two, season four, episode two. Did I do it right the first time? I don't know.
We
I think I did
know.
it wrong the first time.
We know what you're talking
Everyone knows.
about.
We'll edit that out. Anyway, big blanket spoiler warning for everything from True Detective season four up to this point on the other side here and potentially from previous seasons. Yeah.
Okay, we are back, ready to talk through True Detective Night Country, Season 4, Part 2. Also, and again, written and directed by Issa Lopez, same as Part 1. After the events of Part 1, where a research team is discovered missing, they were found in the frozen tundra at the end of that Part 1. The Part 2 picks up with Liz Danvers and her team finding a way to move the victims from the tundra where they were found to a local ice skating rink. So they continue to not only look for evidence, but wait for them to thaw and see how they can look inside these frozen bodies to try to determine what has happened. It's quite the frightening and gruesome scene, and questions remain as to why they are in the position they are, why they are in various states of decay, why they have no clothes on. A lot of mysterious questions to be answered. Meanwhile, Captain Connolly, Liz Danvers' boss, comes to town, who they apparently have a long relationship that has gotten quite personal over the years. He threatens to take the whole case, move it to Anchorage so that the state authorities can take over, but Liz Danvers fights back on that. We see Evangeline Navarro pop back up in this episode as well, as they are following separate leads of this one case. And following those leads, they both come to the same conclusion that this case must be connected to the 6-year-old cold case that Evangeline was trying to find the killer for the young woman who was murdered. They both narrow in their search on one of the 8 men named Raymond Clark. And as the bodies thaw at the skating rink, they discover that Clark is not among the dead researchers. Meanwhile, throughout the town, tensions are boiling over between the native population and the workers of the mine over an issue of contaminated water that is making people sick. So there's sort of, in addition to this case happening, there's this tension happening amongst the whole town of Ennis, Alaska. So that's the very surface level way of describing what's happened here. A lot of layers to this episode, a lot of things uncovered. Where would you like to begin?
Well, let me just first say very briefly that the stuff with the water and the contaminated water, I have nowhere to go with this, but I have the gut feeling that like that's going to be the key thing. I don't know why, but it's like, why is it there? Is it just kind of setting in the background? I feel like I just have the feeling, the hunch, as it were, that that's going to factor in more than
It's not this just there to set the stage for what the motif of this town is. It's there for a reason.
I don't know. I don't know. I have a feeling. I mean, I can't go very far with it. I guess we know that there is some connection to Annie K being an activist and objecting to the mine and ruffling the feathers of the local muckety mucks, which I guess is that woman Kate, who's in the ice rink. I guess she owns the ice rink too. So like there's something there, I guess, but I don't know. I'm curious how much that will factor
Their
in.
normally clear and clean water has turned dark, has turned black, as it were. So maybe we'll see how that connects.
The symbolism. Is it black goo? There's an article on the site at tvobsessive.com that David Titterington wrote a few years ago about black goo and the symbolism of black goo. It's very, very interesting. Is this black goo? I don't know. Definitely continuing a supernatural vibe, continuing a horror vibe. Starting with the cold open, I have a question. I don't know if we have an answer. Is that guy alive?
So this is one of my questions too. So here's my math. Let's see, check me on this if I'm right. When they sort of count heads at the end of the episode, they name off six and say one is missing. Danvers took a phone call after they moved the bodies, and she's talking to a nurse and says he's not going to be able to talk today. He's in an induced coma. We're going to surgery right now.
Yeah.
I think that we see in the beginning one of them vocalize something, and that guy somehow is alive and been taken to a hospital. So that's my math on the eight researchers.
I think so too, but at the same time, all I'm saying is my notes say corpse screams. So, like, I mean, if he's alive, how?
How?
That doesn't make any sense. I mean, these guys have been missing for a couple of days are being found out in the middle of the frigid Arctic cold with no clothes on. They're all frozen together.
So this is a question of mine of what was the period of time? I think, as you allude to, it's less than 2 days between when they're discovered or when discovered they're missing and when the bodies are discovered. But it's been a longer period of that, clearly. I mean, maybe even up to a week that they may have been missing to when they are discovered. I think the timestamp on when they open up the phone, it says something like December 17th. That's when he's making the sandwich. And then we see in the show that it's December 21st. So maybe it's been 4 days. But how much time does it take for bodies to get that frozen, that decayed within the, I mean, the timelines, I'm trying to sort it out here, but certainly a guy is not going to survive outside, no clothes for that long, whether it's 1 day, 4 days, whatever it is.
So hours, so that's very strange. Other things that are strange, the discovery of the folded clothes, and my other big question about this is, was this a murder? Were these men murdered?
And I think that you, them, all of us are asking that right question of what has done this? What could have done this? We see burned retinas, people chewing their limbs off, ruptured eardrums. Obviously, they don't have clothes on. They're in sort of stages or states of horror or fright. So, yeah, we're very much considering the fact is this a who or what that did this to them? And I think that they're kind of considering that already amongst Danvers and Pryor and the police force. But us with sort of some extra knowledge of what's happening here, they may not be going towards the supernatural quite yet, where I think we are.
Right, and there's a running kind of line in this episode between Danvers and Pete about asking the right question.
Yes,
I don't know if
yes.
I've got the right question. My biggest question would be how, I guess. Whether it's a person behind it, like is it Raymond Clark who's behind it, who somehow killed these guys out there on the ice? But even if he did, how? Is that
And
like
how do
you're
you?
finding a room full of guys who are shot in the head or something?
Yeah, and how do you get them out there? How do you position them like that? What caused them to do these sort of horrific things to themselves that they have done? Yeah, I don't get a sense that it's we have no way of knowing at this point, obviously, but that Raymond Clark and just Raymond Clark alone was able to do these things to these seven men. But is it Raymond Clark possessed by something? Is there something something or entity or group that he's working with to do this? I think it's still way too early to tell.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've had this thought since the beginning that it was kind of like the thing, or make it a little bit more naturalistic. Well, I guess the thing is sort of naturalistic in a way. Some kind of parasite, some kind of, poisoning, But the one guy's missing. What happened to him? And then the other things we learn about that guy starts pointing us in the direction of like, whoa, he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know?
And this is jumping around a little bit, but Devaro is making this connection that Raymond Clark is the one that did something to Annie, that clearly had some sort of connection pre her murder. And so there's just a very clear sense that this could all be a red herring. There's something else there, and something is taken Clark somewhere else, or he is in some state of being possessed by something, and it wasn't. We'd have no way of knowing at this point.
Right. So, and one big thing here is we have the spiral symbol, one of our callbacks to season one,
Yes.
which is on one of the frozen corpses. And then it's discovered over the course of this episode that symbol, well, they already knew that symbol was on Annie's body as a
Yes.
tattoo.
Yes.
But then they also discover that Clark got that tattoo and apparently showed the tattoo artist a picture of Annie. So she had it first. That was something I thought was worth emphasizing. Annie had it first.
Yeah, and will we ever understand or know or have it told to us where she got the idea or where she got the design from? I mean, like I said, clearly this is a symbol, a design, an element that was present in season one, which takes us all the way back to 1995. And presuming we're in present day today, what's been the connection to that season, to that symbol? But we did actually get a big connection to that season in this episode by way of a certain name.
Yeah, I mean, let's go there. Let's flesh this out. There are a couple more things, I think. The trailer, and then were you referring to Travis?
Yeah.
Yeah. Travis Cole.
Yeah, so we get a full name of Travis Cole, Rose's husband, mentioned in this episode, and obviously we will be far from the first to make the connection that in True Detective season one, Rust mentions that he has a father named Travis who lives in Alaska. And so now that the last name is connected to this Travis, we can only assume that these are one and the same. And we'll just have to sort of now try to connect the dots of what's the through line here of how this happened and what the connection is.
Right. I mean, it seems because it's a TV show, right? It seems fairly clear that they're telling us that this is Russ's father,
Yeah.
Travis in Alaska, Travis Cole. It's a little less clear to me that he was Rose's husband, actually. And I don't know if it's worthwhile at all to like kind of pick this nit, as it were.
Yeah.
But at least like her lover or something. But it's not. I don't think it's ever exactly said that they were married, unless I missed it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, yeah, they talked about a sense of how they were. Apparently they were very close. They were intimate. They were partners in a number of ways. They loved each other. He had this illness. For this illness took his life. He went and took his own life inside the ice. But then, yeah, let's just put it this way. There's no way it's a coincidence. And they just didn't check or forgot to,
No, yeah, right. It's not.
it's
It's not. This
not a
is TV. This
coincidence.
is True Detective. I guess the biggest reason I felt like maybe that's worth noting is I don't know that we can conclude anything like, well, Rose is Travis's mother or something.
Yeah.
I don't think so, actually. I don't know. I don't know how much more this will be filled in. From what we got in season one, there is this idea that Travis Cole has been missing for 30 years or something like
Yeah.
that. And
Yeah, no one's heard from him for 30 years. So yeah, how the timeline works, it's kind of up in the air, especially since there's three different sets of time in season one. We don't know anything about this Travis and his age and what year he passed away. So it's kind of
yeah.
fuzzy, but maybe it's left that way intentionally.
Though I think you're right. I think they do put it that way. So maybe he wasn't missing. Maybe he just like took off for Alaska and like never, didn't keep in touch with anyone at all. Just
Yeah.
estranged from his former life before he went to Alaska. I don't know. But they mentioned
Yeah,
the name, so.
something residual from that has remained with Russ Cole there in Louisiana. I think you and I both discussed how, I think we're going to have to plow back through season one to see if there's any connections we pick up. We know some of the influences that Issa Lopez had for this story, But she's clearly being influenced by some of the themes from previous seasons of this show as well.
Yeah, I mean, my ultimate question as we go through the remaining four episodes here would be, in terms of how it relates to season one, are there going to be meaningful connections to the mystery in a way where, like, maybe even season four is going to answer questions we had in season one that we might have forgotten about? Or is it going to be just a, not just because it's cool, but is it going to be a matter of callbacks, references, allusions, thematic resonances, vibes? Like, it might just be that, and that's fine and good too,
I
but
think you touched on this last week, and you certainly have mentioned it to me just in our offline conversations that season one just scratched the surface of mystical and supernatural, and what were or were there forces like that behind what happened to the children in that season. I wonder if this is now going to build on that mythology, right? We establish the connection, now we build a mythology of what is that force that's causing this to happen. Is it something that penetrates a person or a group or something that causes these things to take place? And when we get more into what it is, how it's defined by that symbol, is it really just this idea of evil is a circle that will continue and we will not learn from it, and it will embody us if unless we do something to change it? Sort of drawing on this, expanding on the theme from season one.
yeah, maybe. Let's focus a bit on the sort of mundane details we get, right? Navarro tracks down this trailer that Clark had purchased, so he could apparently, like, have this kind of secret affair with Annie, apparently, and goes and discovers this trailer, which has apparently been sitting. I don't know if I can say that. Did Clark keep going back to it over the past 6 years, or has it been sitting like that for 6 years? I don't
Looks
know.
like it's been sitting there for quite some time.
It certainly does. And they believe that they found Annie's phone that's just been sitting there, right? Again, she died 6 years ago. But all of this makes it feel like she and Clark were in it together. They're in something together. And that something, it's like very big flashing lights at us metaphorically, makes us think, oh, season one, Yellow King, the spiral, yeah, all of that.
Especially when that symbol shows up. And I think there's also a sense of the idea that that's sort of the occult, that's something that has some evil behind it. But also, it sounds like perhaps for Raymond and Annie, their relationship was something that within this town, within the confines, sort of this environment, was forbidden, something that people would not have wanted to happen. There not seem to be good relationships between certainly the local migrant workers and the native population there. What in their relationship was? Were they trying to hide? Why are they trying to hide it? How is Raymond? It seemed like they were making a point that these researchers stay there, don't leave, don't accept visitors, never take breaks. They're there forever. So what's he doing? Sort of escaping from there to go have this rendezvous with Annie. Sort of what's the background there? I think that will provide sort of a key that unlocks maybe a lot of this.
Yeah, and to take the perhaps too obvious suggestion from season one, we had the thought there of, well, it's a pedophilia ring and so on, right? So is that what they were getting into? We don't
And
know these people.
Annie was a teenager 6 years ago. Is that what we understand? Or was she, I
I
guess she
don't
was
know. I don't know if we
older.
got her age. I think I had the I was under the impression that she was more of like a young adult.
That's my impression too.
Like maybe 20, 18, 19 or something. I don't know. I have to see if we got indications, but anyway, it does look, just trying to put pieces together, it seems like she and this guy Raymond Clark from the research station were into something together, and it doesn't seem like it was just sexy time, because you look at that trailer and, like, what's going on with the there's a figure in the bed. It's like all kind. This is like you walk into that trailer and look around and run away if you're a
Yes.
normal person. You're like, this is creepy.
Yes, exactly. That was
So.
to me, it was reminiscent of when they found the two kids in the woods in season three,
Yeah.
that as those discoveries were being uncovered, they found these sort of wicker or stick toys that were placed with them. There was someone who was under suspicion who was making these toys, selling them at a market. They look very similar to these things, whether it's the same or not. We don't know. We already know that there was a connection between season three and season one, at least in terms of them being in the same universe. So these sort of ideas and themes and actual physical sort of items are starting to overlap now amongst several of the seasons.
Yeah, and so maybe it does ultimately lead in the direction of some potentially international even
Yeah.
web of, and then maybe there is a real true supernatural spiritual
Yes.
element that ties it
Yes.
together. Or maybe not,
Yeah.
I don't
Yeah.
know. This season definitely is it's presented things like Travis appearing to Rose as though that really happened. And
Yes.
yeah, the conversation between her and Navarro,
Yeah.
where she says, don't mistake the spiritual world for mental health
And
problems, or
you don't have to watch too
other way
many.
around.
You don't have to watch too many scary movies to learn that there is a very common theme of, the new people that move into the house, the spirit sort of takes them over or starts to haunt them, or you're born with something and then you pass that on to your children, you pass that on to your descendants, right? This sort of idea of this supernatural evil force that follows people that have used it or it's been a part of them, so it's not a stretch too far to say that this could have gone from where Travis Cole was originally from up there to Ennis, Alaska, or it originated there, as people have been alluding to this idea of this perpetual darkness is sort of this sense of things happen differently during this period of time. Things
Yeah.
operate differently. There's
Or
the, as I heard it's put, the barrier between life and death is much smaller than it had been in other times.
yeah, and of course, there's all sorts of symbolism about this, like getting outside of the order of the cosmos and
Yep.
into like in Plato's Timaeus, there's this stuff about the chora as the unformed matter prior to the formed cosmos, and I don't know, there's all sorts of symbolism along those lines, and don't want to get too into the weeds, start talking about Plato, obscure Plato too, like Plato from grad school level Plato, but it's one thing that came to mind for me, and there's all kinds of history about that kind of linking of the dark and the unformed and the feminine also.
Yes.
So I definitely think this season's playing with that kind of trope, as it were.
Yeah. So let's dig into the deaths a little bit more, and sort of the idea surrounding them. So you touched on the idea of the folded clothes and the shoes that Navarro stumbles on, at the beginning. So this is a, they were cognizant of what they were doing. Somebody took that off of them, and sort of this, maybe I've watched too much Criminal Minds, but sort of in this sociopathic or empathic way of fold their clothes and are taking care of their things after they do this thing to them. It's just all sort of leading back to this: who or what could have done something like this? But it seems as though, I don't know, it seems as though. Do you think Danvers is really the only one that wants to figure it out? Maybe Danvers and Pryor is the only one that really wants to figure this thing out. Hank has no idea. The captain wants to get it moved. Navarro is more concerned about the cold case. They seem the only ones focused on what's going to be happening here.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of get that impression. Why does Captain Connolly, or whatever his name is, it's something like that, why does he want to move it to Anchorage? Christopher Eccleston, good to see you all, Christopher Eccleston. It would probably be easier to make it go away at the end of the day, Maybe he's looking at it like, well, this is not going to be solvable. I don't know what the hell happened here, but it's not like we're going to figure it out. And
Did you feel, I couldn't tell whether or not that I was felt that it was leading this way, that Danvers felt the case from 6 years ago is unsolvable. She's putting it out of her head. It's not worth thinking about anymore. Is she regretting that? And that's why she's not going to let go of this. She's going to refuse to let anybody else take this over. Or is this sort of a, boy, this is the most interesting, mysterious case we've ever had. We're not giving it to anybody else.
I'm tempted to read it as a connection to the previous case. I don't know that I'm reading it as her regretting having given up on that, so much as her judgment was that they weren't going to solve that. They hit a dead end. And now you've got a new lead. Never mind the fact that the new lead is like the craziest thing in the world that makes no sense whatsoever. I think it's got a, it's got its hooks into her, as it were, with the connection to the old case. I'm imagining that if that connection hadn't been there, she may well have just said, "Oh yeah, sure, take these, crazy ice sculpture of corpses and take the case to Anchorage," and I don't know.
Yeah, this and the, I guess the introduction of the captain who wants to do that opens up several new layers and opens up several new pieces of information about Danvers, right? So she's got a lot of history with people in this town, it sounds like. I still don't know that we've met Leah's father, nor or if we will, if he is gone, if
I think
he's
he's dead, but
yeah,
I
we've
don't know
got
that
this
that's what's.
relationship with the, I guess the town of Ennis, Alaska has a geology teacher for its high schoolers. I mean, that seems a little odd to me, but she's got the relationship with this guy. She's got this very intimate 19-year relationship with the captain. So she's got quite the history of people that will her work or will her effort be, sort of blinded by, or will she be, I don't know, will these relationships that she has get in the way of this work? It seems like she's got a lot of history here with a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question is, how is this going to fit into the overall story? How does it fit one way or the other? You have a flashback scene in this episode. It seems that she had a son. I mean, I was reading someone online saying something about that. I don't feel like the first two episodes of the show have really confirmed that. Maybe it's confirmed elsewhere. But the polar bear was the more intriguing thing. This is a stuffed polar bear toy. It seems to have one eye. And of course, Navarro saw a polar bear with one eye on the road in episode one. And I'm not going anywhere with this. I don't know what to say about this. It just seems noteworthy.
It just seems like one of these things where, they're very, very, again, relevant to True Detective season one, where some kind of past layers, some of the onion was peeled back a little bit every episode, a little bit every episode. We finally got sort of a fuller picture of that. I think we did get a glimpse in one of the flashbacks of Danvers dancing with someone who I guess was Leah's father. And I don't think that's anyone that we've seen so far yet, or that we had seen in other parts of this episode. Yeah. So, I mean, again, it's just another one of these. What are the layers that matter? What are the details that matter? Is it the stuff about the town that will point to where this case should go? Is it the stuff about the relationships? Is the stuff about the past? Is the stuff about how the two cases are connected? Is it stuff about how this season may connect to some of the pieces of season one? It's almost like so many different things to focus on. Which one of them matters, or do all of them matter?
Well, and of course, it's possible that they all matter, even though they don't tie into one another, right? I mean, potentially we've got two stories. One story is about these murder cases, and the other story is about Danvers and her personal life, right? And those might just be kind of two narratives that can both run in parallel in a certain way. And that would be fine. I'm just saying I don't necessarily expect some big clue to stem out of
Yeah. Yeah, that's
the
what I want to go
prisoner.
back and review. Obviously now I should have watched season one before this one, but go back and see, did the past of Marty and Rust, did they matter in an implicit way to what happened with the case? Like, were there any pieces to put together there? I think it more just mattered of how they approached what they were doing and how it approached what, their how they would try to solve this case. And maybe their path led them to be able to do that eventually. And so maybe that's what we'll get with Amber as well.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of what I recall with season one is we cared about the characters, and so there were elements that were just a matter of their story and deepening the characters, and it worked quite well. That's how I recall
Yeah.
season one going. So my expectation is probably something sort of similar here, but
Yeah.
it is noteworthy that it does seem like we've got mystery elements in her personal life. We have questions
Yeah.
that we're looking to be filled in about, moving forward.
And I think one of the big questions for me, clearly she sees Leah. I think we've had it confirmed it's her stepdaughter. We see Leah, who is visiting some let's see, Peter Pryor's in-law family, and they are putting this sort of native markings on her face,
Oh,
and
yeah.
that just completely pisses her off. So there's something there, whether it's in the relationship with the father, what happened to the father, or something with the background of what's happened in this town or with someone in this town that has led her to that, to have that kind of emotion about this.
Yeah, which is interesting. Why does Danvers have such a strong reaction against the idea of Leah
Yeah.
trying to kind of connect to that cultural heritage?
Yeah.
Or just kind of play with it a little bit, right?
Exactly.
But she's not having that at all. So something's going on there. It probably ties into her hatred of the Beatles. I continue to speculate that Leah's father and perhaps also this son we see died at the hands of a drunk driver. And
I think that's a fair assumption considering the drunk driver reference in the first episode. We did not know until this episode that there was a son in addition to a father. And so maybe that son was born from both of them, where Leah was not.
yeah.
I think it's a pretty safe assumption at this point.
That's how I'm piecing things together, but we'll see. We can get more
Yeah.
information. It might, undermine that interpretation, but that's how it feels to me at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
This was just a really good sort of kick the door open to a bunch of possible options episode, right?
Yeah.
Whereas part one was, let's set the stage for how creepy and disturbing and disorienting this is going to be, and now we're going to start to lay down different paths. Which is the right one to take and which one's connected at the end. I think this was, I mean, put together especially, I think these were two very good episodes.
I agree, but I'm excited. I'm more
Yeah.
excited after this one. Well, I watched the first one. I thought, oh, yeah, this is pretty cool. I like the vibes. I like Jodie Foster. I like how
Yep.
it's sort of setting things up, and it seems like it's going to play with supernatural type elements and callbacks to season one. And this is cool. And proceeded to go tell people, yeah, the new True Detective is good. But I watched part two, and I'm like, I want to watch part three right now. I want to keep going.
Yep.
Up through
We've been podcasting for 33 episodes. Have I ever messaged you in the middle of an episode that I was watching to sort of my shock and exasperation with some things? I don't know that I have
No,
before.
I don't think that you have. Other people do this sometimes, and then sometimes I realize a little late that they're in the middle of the episode,
Yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah.
oh wait, okay, I gotta be careful here. I'll tell you what's gonna happen at the end.
Yeah, I had to immediately share my I guess excitement
Travis Cole?
yeah, Travis
Yeah.
Cole. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Stoked. And yeah, we'll continue week to week. We'll put these podcasts out on Sunday night after the episode has aired. Ryan's also writing articles for TVObsessive.com on the season of True Detective. You want to read recaps, reviews, and analyses, whatever term you want to use. Anything else before we go?
No, I think that's it. I think let's leave it on a cliffhanger. This was one question that's left outstanding here of we believe, or we're assured, right, that this is not a real Russian bride that's communicating with Hank Pryor, right?
Oh, we missed that. Yeah, listen to
Yeah.
that.
So
I do
I want to know the
think.
theories. I want to know what people think this is. Who's communicating with Hank Pryor?
Yeah, it's like he's being catfished, right?
Yes, very much so.
Probably, I think. Send me more pictures of you. All right, it's like, oh, okay, here you go, baby. Send me social security number and mother's maiden name. You know, like I don't know.
Yes,
Or maybe not. I don't know. I don't
maybe
know.
not. We'll see. This guy beat up on his son. He deserves to be catfish. So we're that's what I'm hoping for.
We'll see. But it definitely, he definitely got that impression here that this is, he's being scammed in one way or the other. So we'll see how that goes. Again, join us each Sunday night. Listen to the podcast on True Detective over the next 4 weeks. And check out tvobsessive.com, read Ryan's articles. There's also some stuff on there on season one, at least, and articles on season three. I don't think we have anything on season two. If anyone, you know, wants to pitch an article on True Detective season
Yeah.
two, you hit me up and let me know. I'll probably say yes. But okay, again, Ryan and Cameron, check out the website. Join us next week. Follow us on social media, and Ryan, I'll see you then.
See you next time for part three.